This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you ready to chart your path to financial independence? Sure you are. Get started with Portfolio Analyst by Interactive Brokers. Portfolio Analyst lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all of your financial accounts on a single powerful dashboard. And the best part? It's free for everyone. No IBKR account is required. Plan for your future with their new retirement planner, tailored to your preferences and market assumptions. Unlock deep portfolio insights with comprehensive risk assessments. Drill into specific metrics like portfolio holdings, allocations, and performance. Track your performance against more than 300 benchmarks. Plus, manage your portfolios confidently with GIPS verified returns. Sign up for a portfolio analyst for free at ibkr.com/freepa. Because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Member SIPC.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Three days and it all changed. Yen carry trade. Central banks are breaking things once again. Markets move and investors freak out. And the VIX makes a historic move. And our guest today, Dan Fajella, founder and head of research of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. All this and much more on episode number 881 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. What the hell is happening? I mean, that's probably something you've said to yourself, asked yourself, talked to somebody else about, asked somebody else about recently because, man, there was some wild stuff going on this week, right? Well, I hope that clears a few things up and that's the end of the show. No, we got a lot to talk about. We are going to talk about things related to what has gone on. We're going to take a cursory look at that. I'm Andrew Horowitz. Hope you're good. Hope your summer officially now coming to an end soon. You know, obviously we have to abide by when you could wear the white shoes and the white pants, and it's almost over. It's a lot of time left in a way for outdoor stuff, but back to school is just around the corner. Again, buying all those back to school goods. And I bet, I'm certain, that you've been asking yourself, what's going on? When do we see these kinds of moves so suddenly? And while maybe a lot of us expected it, maybe you're saying to yourself, oh, you know what? That was obvious. There was something that was not right in the markets. But why this sudden shift? Why all of a sudden on, you know, the first part of August? Why then? When we talked about this and explained a lot of what went on, the nitty-gritty details on DH Unplugged this week. I host that with John C. Dvorak. As you know, if you haven't listened to this week's episode, I highly, highly encourage you to do so. That is where probably in the first, in the first 15 minutes of the discussion, we talked about that. We got into the yen carry trade and the boneheaded move by the Bank of Japan and how that impacted pretty much every asset class out there. And it got so bad, this move by the yen, this move against the dollar in particular, that was for years and years and years, one that just would see the yen going down against the dollar. 17 years since the last time that the Bank of Japan raised rates, and all of a sudden, things are breaking. And this forced selling that went on was something we discussed, why it happened, how it happened, and I think something that you need to be aware of. So over the last couple of months, we pounded the opportunity to think about volatility and the lack of volatility. We talked about it right here. We talked about that we thought that into July and August, there'll be an increase. And boy, was there an increase. And not at all what I was anticipating. And that kind of move, but sure did hit with the VIX moving up to 65. I mean, wow, 65. When was the last time that that happened? You got to look back to 2008. You got to look back to 2020. And we know those were calamities. Those were in the 80s on the VIX. But 65 after it was 17 3 days ago and then just blast to 65, that was a level of panic that was pretty much historic. I mean, this time I think that investors are sniffing out the massive leverage in the system and saying, you know what? We're going to throw some shade on that whole idea. We're going to look at what's going on with these central banks who have been BSing their way through this for years, printing money, raising debt, looking at where GDP in the U.S. is 130%, debt is 130% to GDP, and looking at that saying, we used to laugh at countries that had that. Now, fortunately, hopefully you were pretty well diversified. Our clients were well diversified. Bonds kicked in last week, and they were a nice buffer. Excess cash we had in some situations, and hedges, as I mentioned, on the TDI managed growth strategy that dampened some of the downside. And by the way, something you may want to consider at this point, because I don't think we're done with this volatility. I think this is the beginning of something. We never see just that. Now, there were some things back in July that were, I would say, precursors or maybe even little alerts that happened that we should have known about and that we did see. But, you know, this volatility is not just one and done. So if you want to see what we're doing, what you can, you know, maybe we can look at what's going on with you to make sure you're set up properly. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and let's talk about how to set up your portfolio up in a way to weather some of the potential storms that could be on the way. So just do the contact us or check out the different ways we manage money. The strategies on there too, by the way. I want to keep it short at the beginning in this opening monologue today because we're going to talk about other things. We could talk about, of course, the impact of the jobs report, the massive move on Asian stocks. But again, I want to focus on artificial intelligence. And we've talked around this and through this and in and out this for some time. But I thought, you know what? It's time. Let's get into the discussion of, I mean, roll up our sleeves and get in the muck. Let's talk about exactly what AI is and what it isn't, what the opportunities are for us as investors, as human beings, as a society, and as a world. And I thought we'd bring in someone who I think is the perfect guest for this. I've talked to him before, and this time I want to focus in on this whole idea of what is AI and AGI too. So I have a lot of questions to ask. Let's bring him on right now and get to the bottom of all this. And our guest today is Dan Fagelli. He's the founder and head of research of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. And he's an internationally recognized speaker on the use case and ROI of artificial or AI in the business. He's been around since doing this for years, but since 2015, he's focused on direct market research interviews with Fortune 500 AI leaders, AI unicorn startup founders, and leading academics. Some of the things that you may not know about him. Number one, he's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, winning the title in 2011, national champion at the Pan American Games. He graduated with a master's degree in positive psychology from UPenn, and he focuses his thesis research on skill development, skill acquisitions. Born in Wakefield, Rhode Island, this is where I found most interesting. He now lives in Boston because Dan, you know what I did this weekend?
What'd you do?
I had quahogs and stuffies and lobster in Cohasset, Newport.
Oh man, that's the most Boston thing you can do.
Flew out of Logan on Monday to get back here. So hey, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So let's talk about, let's start out with some groundbreaking discussion. Here we go. For the listeners out there that have listened to me for years, and they're probably saying a lot of times, what the hell is AI anyway? Let's just start with that.
Yeah, sure. All right. Well, I'll try to shake out the simple version. There are some more technical and complex definitions, but if we're talking about AI, the really simple definition would be a computer doing work previously very much relegated to what humans would do. So that's how broad the definition of AI is. Today, most of the excitement around AI, Andrew, is really around machine learning. Machine learning is the ability to not just hard code a system to do things that humans could do, but have a system learn from data inputs to be able to kind of adjust on the fly and literally learn. So learn how to detect, you know, a child bouncing a basketball in the road if I'm an autonomous car, learn how to detect fraud in an insurance application if I'm looking for fraud, et cetera, et cetera. So AI is a very broad term, but most of the time nowadays we're talking about machine learning, which is this kind of adaptive new branch of AI, which has been very, very popular over these last 12 or 13 years.
So the follow-up question that I think would be from a lot of people, is it coming for me? Is it going to take my job? I'm the guy that, does the fraud check on insurance, I'm the gal that's doing the research into user proclivities in terms of advertising. I mean, is this coming for my job?
Got it. Well, look, it's a far too broad question to sort of sweep across the totality of possible jobs in the United States. What I would tell you is it is definitely coming for the white collar faster than the blue. But it will eventually come to the blue. There are many, many hurdles and challenges for it to really start taking massive chunks out of the job market. I do think it is somewhat inevitable. And I do think that there are some areas, like some components of creative and marketing, some components of legal, some components of customer experience, depending, where the low-hanging fruit seems quite low. But I will be frank with you, my work is talking to, if you look on our podcast, right, the AI and Business podcast, CIO Goldman Sachs, Chief Technology Officer Takeda Pharmaceutical, Head of AI Raytheon, right? This is a week in my life is just kind of talking to the people spending the most money on this stuff in the legacy enterprise space. And then also talking to the hottest companies that sell it, your Palantirs and your Googles and your, right? We talk to both sides of the house, and I will give you very firm, very staunch conclusions about job automation. And that is mainly that legacy enterprise is so almost unbearably slow and kludgy to be able to adopt this technology that we have not seen large sweeping changes in the talent pool as of yet. We have not seen American Express slough off, two-thirds of their call center staff. We have not seen Geico slough off, half of the people that are doing their auto insurance of fraud analyst work. We have just not seen it just yet. And everybody was thinking, maybe the truck drivers are all going to get automated. We're not there yet. There's all kinds of separate problems with autonomous vehicles. But within general industry, the main issue is to adopt this technology requires culture change, requires workflow change, requires an understanding of AI within the C-suite. And to be frank, Andrew, it has been such a painful, slow, and kludgy process of adoption that we're just not seeing big chunks of big companies actually dumping folks because of AI. I do think it's inevitable. I think many of these dinosaurs I'm talking about will die off. They will go the way of all the other dinosaurs. But we're not there tomorrow. So
I think one of the other things that's happening that is preventing the job layoffs in mass is the parallel testing, that parallel of, okay, we kind of trust this to do this, but what if? And on two levels. One, making sure that there's no glitches in the system, bad information, and oversight till it's fully trained and up to a level. The second thing is the other side, the acceptance of that. Like, I go into a thing and you get a little chat bot that comes up into Geico or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I'll go with this for a second, And then I'm like, operator, totally, assistant,
totally,
I don't want to deal with this because I'm getting these just, rigid regurgitations of stuff that is just out there, which I have another question. My question isn't the ones they came up with yet. So I think there's that going on. Would you agree with that? I mean, is that kind of?
Absolutely. Yeah. Massively. So look, especially with Gen AI, everybody's afraid of, what is called hallucinations. If you go on Google, you
right,
in Gen AI hallucinations, it's, these systems will invent stuff that doesn't quite exist. And by the way, that doesn't mean it's a bad technology. It just means by itself, it is often not the best tool to permanently and completely handle a regulated process or a customer interaction. It simply means it might be beautiful for informing a human agent, but not beautiful in replacing that agent in their entirety. And so, so there is all kinds of flim-flam around hallucinations. Also, enterprises play defense. That's what they do. Legacy enterprise plays defense. Very few people in legacy enterprise wake up in the morning and say, man, you know what I want to do? Open up new lines of business. Find new ways to serve our customers. Find new ways to reimagine our operations that are going to set us up to win three years from now in terms of how the market's going to be competing. Very few people in enterprise do that. Most people in enterprise are, you know, pretty excited to make sure they keep getting their paycheck, and they often don't want to stick their neck out for that kind of stuff. And even if they do, their boss doesn't want to stick their neck out. And right. So you need so much approval to make any kind of change that's transformative. And there is a tremendous amount of anxiety around where this tech is a good fit and is not a fit. And to your point, many of the customer-facing waves of this tech. So about 5-6 years ago, we had a very goofy phase of chatbots, 2019-ish. We saw this big kind of wave of chatbots, total goofball nonsense, never should have faced a customer, but every bank under the sun bumped a chatbot out. Everybody that signed a contract with a knick-knack paddywhack startup in Minnesota to build chatbots was doing a press release, right? Because they wanted the press, they kicked the press release out before the ink was dry on their stupid startup contract because they wanted to tell the world they're innovating, even though they haven't done anything. And even though the company they signed with doesn't have anybody talented. So everybody just wanted to signal, you know, that stuff faced a customer for about a week and a half, and then it all chilled out. And so there's been some pain points with getting this stuff customer facing. The fact of the matter is there is massive value within all kinds of departments for back-end processes, not even facing customers, back-end processes. But the kludge of approvals and bravery required to enact these changes has made significant transformative workflow change, I really hate to tell you, essentially non-existent in legacy enterprise. I hope that changes, not because I want people laid off, Andrew, but because I don't think we can stay dinosaurs if China is leveling up and if other areas in the world are leveling up.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So let's talk about then the current impact of AI and who does this actually help? Like, I know we talked about, you know, that jobs may be lost and there may be, you know, this or that benefit, but who like today in this, I don't even know where we are. Are we in V1, V2? Are we in beta? Where are we? First of all, in this AI thing, and then who does this actually help? Like, I'm talking about me and you, right? I'm talking about the listener. Yeah. So where are we in? We could talk about it in baseball terms of what inning, or we could talk about it in technology terms. You know, are we in beta V1, or are we in somewhere like post release 1.2?
All good. So let me walk you through, you're inventing kind of these phases, and I like the fact that you're thinking that way. Fortunately, we've done some thinking about this as well, just talking to all the buyers and the sellers. And there's a piece, if people want to Google it, they can Google, EMERJ and then just AI zeitgeist. So emerge AI zeitgeist. And we basically break this into three phases, Andrew. So phase one is sort of emergence. Phase two would be adoption, and phase three would be dispersion. Mm-hmm. So emergence, and now, by the way, I'm going to be brutally simplistic here, but bear with me. Yep. Emergence is, hey, there's some new possibilities on the horizon, and there's some new interesting ways we can pop this stuff into our workflows. Let's see how it goes. That's emergence. It's just popping on the scene. Hasn't really been tested. We're still guinea pigging everything, and it might work really well in a stupid little startup demo, but it doesn't really work really well inside of Geico or inside of Wells Fargo or inside of GlaxoSmithKline or whatever. That's emergence. Adoption is, you know what? This workflow pretty much permanently can be leveled up, improved. Maybe it involves less headcount. Maybe it just involves more effective humans that are getting twice as much done. This workflow is really a great fit for AI. It fits its way into our IT structures, fits its way into our workflows for our boots on the ground employees. It's understood as a part of our strategy, and okay, we're using it. That's adoption. Mm-hmm. And then dispersion is a phase by which, Andrew, we stop talking about AI because we take for granted that anything technology or IT is AI. We stop making the distinction. So you probably very frequently, Andrew, you wouldn't say, oh, I know someone with an internet startup. Because if you said that, you would either sound like you're 87 years old Or you would sound like the year is 1996, right?
Yeah.
You sound like one or the other. And you probably don't want to sound stupid either way, so you don't call them an internet startup. Why don't you call them an internet startup? Because if you're a startup and you're not on the internet, you don't exist. And so it's taken for granted. So where are we now? We are very firmly still in emergence. We are dangling a couple toes into adoption in some fraud workflows, CX workflows, and other workflows. But in legacy enterprise, we are in emergence. We are dangling a couple toes into adoption. We are so far from dispersion in legacy enterprise, it's not even funny. But what you wanted to know was more about the everyman, the man on the street outside of Geico. Is this what you wanted?
Yeah. And every woman too.
Got it. Yeah, sure. Whatever. Yeah, all good. Every horse, every dog. Right. So you can identify as anything. And you can go to the Olympics and identify as everything.
Seems that
so,
way.
Look, in terms of in terms of just a person on the street, I would say if you're just a regular old person and you got a regular old job, there's a very high likelihood you're using AI in some way, shape, or form if you work in legal. There's a very high chance you're using AI, Gen AI in particular here, in some way, shape, or form if you work in creative. Mm-hmm. So what is creative? It's advertising, it's content creation, it's graphic design, right? If you're pure creative, social content, if you're pure creative, you're deep in legal and like legal researchy stuff, or you are an engineer, right? You're writing code. Your job is producing ones and zeros and fucking hash signs and whatever the hell else you're typing in to make your Python code work and your Ruby on Rails work or whatever you're doing. Then in those three categories, there's a pretty good likelihood that the people that are tuned in now who are using Gen AI tools in a way that really is helpful are doing it there. And our own research suggests this, and sort of a lot of anecdotes do as well. So where is it making its way into the everyman? It's there. However, Andrew, I want us to take one step back and I want to say, brother, AI, in terms of the day-to-day human experience, you, me, your mother, this has been everywhere for a long time.
Yeah.
How many times do you Google something every day? Sure. How many times do you use an app to tell you how to get directions to a restaurant? How many times do you scroll Netflix? Do you scroll
Siri,
YouTube?
Siri.
All of these are algorithmically driven, right?
Yeah.
So AI has been around for a hot minute, a real hot minute. But Gen AI is starting to bumble its way into those three kind of working categories I mentioned to you.
You know, it's fascinating because there's so many distinctions about what it is. I mean, a lot of people know what ChatGPT is and using it for just either enhancement creation or even simply grammatical checks using like the OpenAI's, you know, ChatGPT. Wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful. And now, of course, you could do it with Microsoft with their bots and Copilot. And I've been in meetings where you use Copilot just to summarize meetings, and it's pretty cool stuff. I mean, it's pretty cool stuff. It definitely is productivity gains or will be in the future. There's a learning curve, which will probably set you back a little bit. Then it will, once you learn it, it will push you forward, right? You have that thing going on. But there's a lot of trends in different industries. And I think, as you mentioned, when you talk about Gen AI in terms of creative advertising, things of that nature, where you have to do that side of things, or legal, where you're using some of the even the just the LLMs and all that to give you the back test. It's like a super search, super smart, you know, and that's why Google's heading this on strongly, because if they don't, they're dead. They're dead.
Yeah. Right? Yes, sir. Yep.
So let's look at the trends of AI, and let's look at different industries that impacts. Before we do that, we'll take a quick break, and then I'm going to come back because I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the long-term consequences. I want to talk about some of the most exciting areas. I have so many questions of AI, and maybe even what the outlook is for War Games and Skynet, but we'll do that in a second. Hang on. So let's talk for a moment about Interactive Brokers and ask the question, are you looking for your next investment opportunity? Well, Interactive Brokers' global analyst tool helps you uncover hidden opportunities in the global market. With its unique features like the World Data Screener, you can precisely pinpoint undervalued stocks by comparing prices and financial metrics of global stocks all in the same currency. Plus, the World Map Screener allows you to quickly find stocks that meet your specific financial criteria across the universe of global equities. Now imagine the advantage of making better investment decisions with powerful tools at your fingertips. Don't miss out on the next great investment. Experience the power of IBKR Global Analyst for free today at IBKR.com/global analyst. Because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Member SIPC. And we're back with Dan Figeli, of course, from Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. We're going to have all the information available and how to get in touch with him. His podcast, that's great, over on the show notes for episode number 881 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We left off, I had so many questions. I left off, I think, on the question of trends. I'm gonna read some, I jotted down some industries. And I want to get your thoughts on maybe quickies on each
industry.
Absolutely.
I got plenty for you, brother.
All right, here we go.
I mean, we talked to everybody.
I got banking, retail, advertising, manufacturing, healthcare. Go.
Great. Okay. Let's just tear through them. So here, tell me if this is the right place to focus, because if you want me to focus elsewhere, I can. What I generally talk about, if we're talking like on a stage, in a panel, whatever, is going to be, hey, within an industry, where's the money actually being spent? Where's the impact actually being spent?
That's what I like.
Yep. Okay, bada bing. So this is that we are in the business of where the money goes and where the money sees an ROI, and also where it's flopping, right? Where the ROI is failing.
Yep.
So if you want to talk banking at present, and all of these things are only for now, and I'm sure these trends are going to shift, but for banking in general, we really are adoption has, from our vantage point, funneled primarily into risk-oriented workflows. What do I mean by that? I mean fraud, anti-money laundering, the prevention of insider trading, compliance-related workflows.
Yeah.
Why? Well, because defense is what big companies do. If you tell a big company, man, you might be able to 15X your revenue in this product line over the next 10 years, they're probably just not that excited. Because like, I'm just getting a salary, I don't really care. But if you tell them, man, you could reduce the chance of being slapped by a regulator by 0.004%, they're more excited about the latter than the former. I don't make the rules. This is how companies work, and this is how they spend. Yep. And if an AI company has any brains, they learn very quickly.
Yeah.
You must appeal to pain. And so what has happened is that we've seen a huge amount of investment in those risk categories I just gave you. There has been a lot of talk and a lot of press releases about customer experience in banking. There has not really been substantial dollars flowing into customer experience compared to the risk workflows that I've articulated to you. In addition, we see a significantly less investment, but generally more sophisticated investment in wealth management. Like the folks that are doing the trading, those departments are much more technically savvy. They're actually a little bit eager to get a cutting edge and not purely to play defense. They might not be spending as much as that giant slice of risk I articulated to you, but there is action there. So there's action and demand at the cutting edge of the money making, and there's a lot of action and demand in the places where the regulator is going to slap us or the fraud or compliance issues are going to hit us hard in the face. So that's banking. What was the next industry?
Retail.
Great.
So retail. When I'm talking retail, I'm talking like shopping and things like malls and even online.
Got it. So brick and mortar or digital. Yep. I can talk about either, but really we got a lot of commonalities here. Retail is a weird legacy industry, and I'll tell you why. Because they buck a very, very big trend, and that big trend is pure defense, pure defense, pure defense. If I look at where, you know, the money's being spent across FinServ, so insurance, banking, you know, if I look at like manufacturing stuff sometimes, life sciences has a couple examples. A lot of it is like, we just don't want to step in the wrong direction. We want efficiencies and we want risk reduction. In retail, a lot of the action is in personalization recommendation. This could be through a mobile app. This could be through email promotions. This could be through the content that we're feeding people. This could be through a loyalty program where we have some ongoing communications. There's a lot of focus there. And I think in large part, everybody and their mother kind of looks to Amazon in this category. And Amazon has very much kind of set the trend here. And I think recommendation is so patently, obviously a moneymaker for them that very early on, when the first wave of retail startups got kicked off, this is maybe 10 years ago, a lot of them were in recommendation personalization. It's a very rich and mature space. And we see a lot of action there. Mm-hmm. The other area, okay, the second big chunk would be supply chain and logistics. Chain and logistics. So when is my inventory, when is this item going to hit inventory? How much of this do I need to order and by when and from which supplier? All of these issues. We work with a ton of these startups. A ton of these startups do go to market through us. This logistics supply chain ecosystem, there's a lot of action and activity here. There's companies like Scandit, companies like Orchestro, companies like Four Kites, companies like, I could just sit here for 45 minutes and rattle them off for you. There's a lot of action there, but those would be our two big chunks and categories within retail. It's like, is the stuff going to hit the damn warehouse? And am I going to have enough stuff to like sell to people in the right way and yep. efficiently? And then also, can I dangle the right offers in front of the right eyeballs in a physical location or digital location to get them to buy? Those are the two places where cash is moving right now.
And by the way, this is one of the reasons why I like a company called Toast in the retail restaurant business. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yes.
But basically it does the same thing for a restaurant. It tells you about, you know, what are you selling? What are you not selling? What's inventory do you have? What things can you do better on? You know, what areas of the business are humming? Where are you seeing the best ROI? Where are you lagging? Do you need more employees on for this particular night? That, you know, you could use all of that information with a point of sale system, by the way. But that's the kind of thing that is really exciting, I think, for, I guess we'll call it productivity gains, right? Across all of the whole side of retail.
Totally. I mean, there's oodles of that. I'm just telling you where we see the bulk of the dollars moving. Like Toast is in the restaurant space. Let me be ice cold with you.
Uh-oh.
The restaurant space is so goddamn small. Almost no one who follows the big picture gives a
shit.
I'm not insulting anybody in restaurants, right? I'm just saying no one cares. Right. I'm saying retail is a big money space. Restaurants are a tiny part of that. Let me be real clear. Especially in AI investment, I'm talking billions. No M's allowed, only B's. In investment in AI, retail or restaurants are such, they are the pool that is on the side of the kiddie pool that is for toddlers. There's no action there.
No, I get it.
Comparatively speaking, it's a very dry space compared to pure play e-com and compared to big boy brick and mortar retail. It's very small, very small.
So let me talk about something that I'm going to kind of skip a couple here and get back to, because manufacturing, I think we get the same thing with supply chain and all that and all that. Advertising, I think we understand. It's just, you know, finding out what everybody likes. Talk about dangling a little hook with a little piece of bait right in front of everybody. Healthcare is fascinating to me.
Tough one. Really tough one. Look. I'm going to give you some anecdotes. Hopefully these will be instructive. This is 12 years of talking to startups. So if you show me 10 quote unquote healthcare startups that have raised under 50 million, right? So they're kind of smaller stage. They've raised under 50 million, 10 healthcare startups.
Right.
I'm going to look at my watch for about 24 to 36 months. And I'm going to find 5 dead companies, 3 to 4 companies realizing very quickly that actually their customer is life sciences. And even if they're collecting healthcare data, the only people with budgets is big pharma. And then maybe 1 or 2 of those guys is actually getting paid by healthcare. So let's talk about that. Healthcare is not a very moneyed space. If you look at Mayo Clinic, which is extremely respected, including by me, or you look at, Dana-Farber, right, where my mother goes, like you look at any of these big, you know, impressive brands or whatever, like they're great. But in terms of R&D budgets, they're not exactly Bayer. They're not exactly Merck. They're not exactly Sanofi. And the other thing, and Andrew, it is very hard for me to overemphasize this. No matter how loudly I say this, it has to be said. The amount of stakeholder weirdness that happens in healthcare is a gigantic barrier to adoption. Let me give you an example. Let's say we're doing something around diagnostics. And I'm going to talk to you about the diagnostics, but let's just use that as an example.
Okay.
Diagnostics. Okay. If I'm selling to pharma, the head of R&D can use this AI to maybe speed up some drug development stuff. Like the person who's the buyer, the person, you know, like, and he can kind of push it down. assuming he gets enough buy-in. I'm not saying it's push button. I'm not saying it's easy. But if he can get enough buy-in, he can push it down and hopefully get some of that stuff adopted by his boots on the ground pharma people. In healthcare, if I got some wacky diagnostic solution, even if it's brilliant, the CEO of the hospital chain or what have you might see the financial benefit. The patient might see the health benefit. But the user and the workflow change is the doctor or the nurse. And this is only from anecdotes, but it's a decade of anecdotes. So I hate to tell you, I think it's a strong signal.
Yeah.
the doctors are not a great crowd to do workflow change. Within pharma, there's a little bit more of an ability to top down, say, this is how we're going to work to develop this drug. Within healthcare, there's a lot more ability for it to get cut at the level of sort of the doctor or the boots on the ground worker. Mm-hmm. So we got the patient, we got the worker, we got like the executive crowd. And for those to align is really hard in healthcare. And the real budgets for innovation are a tiny, paltry percentage of what life sciences is. So like I told you, you show me 10 companies under 50 mil in healthcare, all I have to do is look at my watch, Andrew. All I have to do is look at my watch. And they'll die, or they'll go look for life sci dollars, or some of them will survive. It's not a fun place to sell AI.
So that brings us to an interesting point, because now we're talking about a whole different discussion. We're talking about startups, AI. We're talking about technology and the future and how this will really come to life, right? So I guess I got to ask you this. There's just an enormous amount of AI infrastructure investment is being made by the hyperscalers, also private equity, right? Would we
Absolutely.
Agree with that? Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. So private equity, I'm not as much sure as I am with like venture dollars. Private equity, sometimes they'll mess around and buy a vineyard. They'll mess around and buy, you know, a restaurant chain. I would say venture, like the money that chases tech is definitely chasing AI.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
And the hottest tech companies in the entire universe are laser focused, not just on AI, but building artificial general intelligence, my friend. People don't talk enough about that, in my opinion.
So you want to? I can't stop there. You got to. What does that mean?
Yeah.
What the hell?
You have a question. I don't want to interrupt your flow.
No. Tell me what that means. I'll come back. What is artificial general intelligence?
Sure. Yeah. So general AGI. Intelligence. So, OpenAI's stated purpose, and of course they used to be open, right? Now they're not. Their stated purpose is to build post-human intelligence, right? And apparently, you know, use it in a way that's going to serve humanity, et cetera, et cetera. Google, they got DeepMind, express, stated, no holds barred purpose, build AGI.
Yep.
You got Amazon, and also I think Google's thrown in a lot of dollars, throwing money at Anthropic. Stated purpose is post-human intelligence. You've got, like the Chinese government has some stated initiatives very overtly about winning the race to general intelligence. You've got Zuckerberg not hiding it anymore at all, just overtly saying we want to build AGI. So what we're looking at here is everybody knows what the top of the dominance pyramid is. So on the planet called Earth, there is one singular final achievement. The final achievement is building something vastly more capable than humans, and maybe for a couple months, for a couple years, for a couple weeks, whatever it is, riding that pony and wielding that gigantic power. But then after that happens, most likely the changes are going to be very, very wild, probably incomprehensible to humans, and it's likely to be extremely outlandishly unpredictable what happens next. And most people, you know, look at Musk, look at Altman before he was the closest to building AGI. Look at Habasis, look at Ilya from OpenAI, who I interviewed 10, 11 years ago. Look at any of these folks. They've all been very, very clear about the fact that, like, when we build this stuff, man, like, the danger levels are going to be bonkers. Now, you have some people to push back against that. But we are in a world where most people are not in the know, but it's actually not that hard to see. The big game is who can basically build, you know, the god from Silicon, and then hopefully ride that pony for a hot minute, but they all know they have no idea what's going to happen after it comes into existence.
So
this is mostly the world we live in now.
So with all this that's being built, here's the question. You know, we agree that all this money is going in. There is a lot more money going in right now. And all these things, right, whether it's the Microsofts of the world, Googles, or VCs, PEs, if they're putting, by the way, you said we can't use M's, so we'll use B's. And, and we're not, we're talking lots of money to make it very simple. So they're all betting on the ability to monetize these massive investments, some kind of ROI on the back end. What does that, what do you think is going to be the ability for many of these companies to actually monetize? A lot of them are going for the same thing, some separate, but is this going to be something that it's a winner take all? Is it going to be, a, you know, segmented? Yeah. And what happens to the market if it, to the AI money that can't be monetized?
Well, look, at the end of the day, if you want to compete in, let's call it the race to the sand god. So if you're in the sand god race, and there's many companies that are overtly in the sand god race, you are strapping in to spend Bs for as long as it takes.
What is a sand god?
The silicon deity, the AGI, vastly post-human intelligence, something that is to you and I what we are to Labradors, or maybe eventually to, you know, dung beetles. Okay, so if you are in the race to build such a thing, you have to be strapped up, and you have to have a market cap that has not even a T anymore. You got to have a market cap. Or not even a B anymore. You got to have a market cap with a T on it.
Mm.
And so there's only X number of companies, pretty exclusively in the U.S. And China, that realistically have any ability to throw the kinds of unlimited investment dollars in talent, in data, in infrastructure, in hardware innovation, in whatever, at actually doing the big race. There's a lot of hopeful knick-knack paddywhack folks who've got an AGI lab, you know, in Hoboken or something, or I don't know, in Kansas City or so. Like, that's not the race. The race is who has an unending pool of billions to pour at this. So the race to AGI is not for the small fellas. It's only for the big fellas. You said what happens to stuff that's not monetized. I think they buckle up and they suck it up, because I think they realize that so long as you can inch closer and closer and closer, and it's very hard to say that we're not inching closer to something here. If you're inching closer and closer and closer, pretty soon that's going to involve physical embodiment. We're talking about small robots, big robots, industrial robots with all kinds of intelligence, piping data, not just big models getting trained on Wikipedia, big models getting trained on a million robotic instantiations, piping data about tactile, piping data about infrared, piping data about, you know, the movement of their joints and, you know, the its interactions with specific materials in the physical world. All of those investments are not going to stop, because the race is the race. Whoever builds the post-human intelligence first, there is a very likely winner takes all game. And what's going to happen here, Andrew, is at some point, the Department of Defense is going to step in and commandeer these firms. And at some point, there will be firm, staunch efforts towards intergovernmental coordination to prevent a pure arms race of birthing a deity that we don't know what it will do to the rest of.
So that's the guardrail right there? The government is going to step in? Because I was getting to this as you were talking to the build-out.
Yes,
there's got to be something.
Yes, sir. At some point I come from a really small town. So even when ChatGPT hit the scene, nobody from where I come from really cared. But I will promise you there will be an innovation in the next X number of years. I suspect X is vastly less than 10. I suspect X is probably less than 5. There will be an innovation in the next small handful of years where, unless you are unable to access, unless you live on one of those deserted islands outside of India where they only throw spears and, you know, their language is like clicking. Unless you're that, you will understand firmly that the only game in town is, oh my God, are we going to build this thing and let it loose? It's clearly more capable than we are. And when that happens, when the everyman cares, then politics is involved.
Yeah.
Why is Trump and Kamala not competing in terms of their position on AGI? I will tell you exactly why, Andrew. It's because their constituency doesn't give a shit. That's why.
Nor may they understand even what the hell it is.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is going to have to land like a meteor in their backyard. But when that Sputnik moment happens, when that, you know, when it's almost like an alien coming from a different planet, it's like this incredibly powerful, extremely confusing, extremely capable thing is self-evidently here and able to influence the world in ways that we clearly cannot, then I think significantly before that time, the DOD will have commandeered the major labs. And so what you can expect is for Microsoft to be building data centers in Qatar, in Saudi, in other places around the world, okay? Because when the tanks roll up to whatever, man, Silicon Valley, Seattle, whatever, when the tanks roll up, you know, to the data centers in Virginia, when the tanks roll up, I think they're going to want to still have some hands-on power because it is somewhat self-evident after a certain threshold of power. And I'm not telling you it's going to be in 2 years. I think it's less than 10, but I'm not promising you. But at some point we cross a threshold where the tanks roll up and they're still going to want power and they want a foothold. They want places to process data and own these AI models outside of the constituency of the United States. You will see a lot of data center construction and infrastructure investment in the Middle East.
So that is scaring me.
I bet it is, my friend.
That is a scary discussion because we get into so many problems with that where, you know, this is like a giant version of the TikTok dilemma, right? You know, where's the server? Where are we holding the data?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a big concern about privacy because we have you, me, all of us, everybody listening, we have freely given information through just a simple Google search, right? Just what we search for, to actually throwing up our personal information on things like a Facebook, Snapchat, blog posts, Twitter. We willingly will do that because it's free. And nobody's looked over the years and said, nobody thought 20 years ago that they would be used to build the LLMs, right? But we did that. We gave them the information to build all this. And now that it gets even smarter, can dig deeper, the concern about the privacy, which nobody really gives a crap about anyway, but in theory, whereas they're going to take this stuff, whether it's going to be commandeered or exported. Boy, that's ugly.
Anybody who wants to Google it can Google political singularity. And you can look up kind of the definition there. The basic idea is that at some point it will become self-evident to the everyman that really the only game in town is how is this thing going to be birthed and who controls it? It's really the only game in town. It's just like the direction of post-human intelligence will clearly be to a mother in Kansas, self-evidently more important than, you know, who's running the education department in your little town somewhere, because it will self-evidently make a larger shockwave in your world. That day is coming, but we need something strong enough where it shakes up at that level. But I suspect, brother, it is going to be rather ugly. And my ardent hope is that there will be some degree of global coordination outside of a purely red in tooth and claw arms race. I think incentives rule the world. And I think without some degree of coordination, you know, Elon Musk famously has talked about how AGI is like unleashing the demon. It will kill us all, right? Mm-hmm, famously. Mm-hmm. I'm talking for 5, 6, 7 years. What is he doing now, Andrew?
Yeah, building one.
He is building AGI, my friend. Why is he building it, my friend?
It's a defensive move.
Let me tell you why he's building it. Because here's the choice. If you are worth $100 billion and you're in tech, you have two choices. I gotta lay this on you, brother. You got two choices. Mm-hmm. Choice number one, build the silicon god that probably will consume you at some point, but at least you'll get like the pride of achieving the final human achievement. Build the silicon god. It'll probably consume you and your children, but like you'll get the final achievement. Bada bing. Your second option, and you only have two options. Your second option is sit around until someone else builds the silicon god and allow it to consume you, and then be bested by another man in your final hour. Those are the only two choices. And I suspect there are no benevolent people who can wear that crown. I don't think Musk is bad. I don't think Altman is bad. I think they're all humans, just like you and I. And I think they run on self-interested incentives like the rest of humanity. And I think the only way around a brute arms race dynamic where we don't understand what we're conjuring forth to any degree. The only way around that would be some degree of global coordination. So to your point, he's building in a defensive move. Why? Because we're in the state of nature. There's no coordination. Now, coordination may be impossible, but I suspect it would probably be a net good given where we're headed right now.
Hmm. Two more items I want to get to. And is there more? Because I'm shaking right now.
No, you got it.
Seriously, good stuff though. There's a distinction right now in the investing world about, you know, who's the picks and shovels, who's the ones that are going to play through, you know, who's going to be the big players in this and who's going to be the beneficiaries. One of the big, I guess, pair ups we could look at to a degree is NVIDIA and AMD. And there's, I think, a misunderstanding that both are seen as chip companies. When AMD is a chip company, NVIDIA is a platform company. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. I would. But NVIDIA, nobody, myself included, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, started first writing about the next wave of AI hardware outside of just GPUs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there were very many people looking at that market back then anyway. But of those of us who were, very few of us thought, well, surely NVIDIA is going to trample every competitor and be the most valuable company in the history of the universe. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think there was very many people thinking that. I certainly wasn't. I'm not going to give myself any credit with having a crystal ball back then. What seems to have happened is that the cool kids learned to use CUDA. They learned to kind of code and develop on top of GPUs when they went to cool kid grad school. And then when they did cool kid internships at Facebook and Google and whatever. And now the band of humans who are competent in this machine learning, deep learning world, all sort of have a fundamental song and dance they know how to play.
Yeah.
And breaking away from that feels way too risky. And NVIDIA has a more robust ability to scale with you if you're a hyperscaler than any of these small guys. And so as it turns out, the hook of that skill set on top of that quote platform you mentioned has been, to the best of my present understanding, and I'm not an NVIDIA expert per se, this is just me following the hardware space. You know, hardware is not all of what we cover.
Sure,
part.
No, I get it.
But to the best of my grasp here, that has been a large, large part of their fundamental ability to decimate the competition in the AI race. So yeah, I would say what you said is probably fair.
So, I mean, wrapping this all up, you know, there's a lot of opportunity. I don't think there's any question about that. A lot of money chasing that opportunity, which is where you come in, right? And you're talking about the startups and things that they can do and areas. What's the most one? We'll finish on this. What is the, well, before we do that, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to hold you because I want to get some other information. What's the one most exciting thing you see in this space in the next 12 months? But before you answer that, sir, where can people find more about you?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. So if people are interested, if they're tuned in and they're really interested in the business implications of AI, so they want to understand where this is going to affect their industry, or more importantly, how the biggest companies in their sector are using this tech. So if you're in retail, you're in banking, you're wondering, how does he know what's happening in banking? It's because we interview, you know, CIO Goldman Sachs, we interview head of AI US Bank, we interview. So I would say go to emerj.com, which is our website. We've got a newsletter there, but also the AI in Business podcast. It is the longest running and certainly the most substantial and most listened to B2B AI podcast online. It is not for people who write code. It is for people asking, where is the damn ROI?
Yeah.
And we draw that from interviews with the Fortune 500. So I would say the AI in Business podcast is the best spot. Otherwise, Google my name, find me on Twitter if you're interested in that wacky future stuff.
Yep. So where's the one most exciting thing that you could be like that's charged you up and you're like, ah, that is just interesting over the next 12 months?
Yeah, man. Well, look, I'm not going to tell you I necessarily like all of it. I'm also not going to say I necessarily don't like all of it, but I think it's gigantic. I think it's monumental. I think there should be more conversation about it. And I think it possibly has the potential to be sparklingly, brilliantly beneficial. And this is the general transition for us to be living with programmatically generated experiences as a large portion of our life. So do I have 2 minutes to explain this?
Yes.
Okay, I appreciate it. So The way to think about this is this, and Andrew, you would resonate with this. So I would guess that if I had a stopwatch and I was standing over your shoulder every day you were awake for a full week, full 7 days, if I looked over your shoulder 12 years ago, and then I looked over your shoulder last year, my bet is that your total time spent on screens, looking at screens, is probably about the same. It's probably like, I don't know, 10 to 16 hours a day.
Okay.
And now you can tell me if I'm wrong.
That's I'm with you. Multiple screens. We have computer screens.
It might have gone up. It might have gone up by 20, 30, 40, I don't know, maybe 70 minutes per day because of how much better smartphones have gotten. But I would guess your screen time has actually not changed that much.
Okay.
But so you would say, oh, well, yeah, that's a pretty steady line, Dan. That's a steady line. That one's not really changing. Let me tell you a line that's changed, Andrew. In the last, if I went back 12 years ago, I stood over your shoulder with a stopwatch and I timed every minute that you spent where the screen you were looking at was conjured to you by an artificial intelligence. If I went back 12 years versus now, I bet you that that line is popping off. Why? Because all of your social feeds, all of your video streaming, all of your entertainment stuff, maybe even your education stuff, you know, your various Google searches, every time you look up directions, it's probably not MapQuest anymore. like so many of your interactions with technology are conjured forth to you by an algorithm. And so that curve is bending its way very deeply up into the right as we go, right?
Yep.
Let me tell you about another curve. I'd like to tell you about another curve. Another curve, if I stand over your shoulder right now with a stopwatch, I'm not gonna see a lot of this. But in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, I imagine this is the curve that's popping off that people don't understand, in my personal opinion, and I could be wrong, I'm just prognosticating. I believe that the amount that instead of just a YouTube video being popped to you by an algo, a tweet being popped to you by an algo, your email is being filtered by AI, your Google searches, whatever, you're going to be swimming in answers, media, audio, video, completely generated for you in the moment. So instead of Googling, you're going to be walking around your kitchen talking out loud to an AI, asking it questions, and it will be answering in a unique and bespoke way with a voice tone and an experience completely customized to what your goals are, what your preferences are, etc. When you sit down and you want to be relaxed, you will not turn on your favorite Dave Chappelle show that you've seen 20 times. You will say, I want to be relaxed, and it will in real time generate for you content vastly more relaxing than any analog media ever filmed by a human with two legs and two opposable thumbs in the history of the world. It is it's hyper-calibrated to your exact preferences and possibly, and eventually, your real-time biofeedback. So the world we're stepping into is a world where our needs are programmatically, conjuredly fulfilled by AI. And anybody interested in that, again, there's a Googleable term of closing the human reward circuit. But this is a place we're headed that has dystopic elements, but might not be a dystopia. But I believe it is coming, and it is coming fast.
I'm seeing remnants of Sleeper somehow here. The movie there with actually a working robot, but also are you talking about optical implants or glasses or something so that we have that as well to kind of work through the full circuit?
You're doing a great job reading my mind, Andrew. So so everything I just told you, I believe ardently. In the very bottom of my heart, Zuckerberg understood all of that as soon as he bought Oculus. So as soon as Oculus was purchased, I felt like I fully understood that Zuckerberg knows that if he owns the data piping off of an entire human skull, and if he is the one that pipes the data into that entire wrapped up human skull, the power there is just monumental and beautiful.
Yeah.
He knows it. And everybody with a brain knows it. But the fact of the matter is, user interfaces are wacky, wonky things. It's hard to predict adoption. But what I will tell you is, augmented reality and virtual reality are definitely a when and not an if. We are much slower on the when than I would have expected. That's all that I can say. But it is coming.
Interesting.
Yep.
Interesting. Dan Fagella, head of research of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research, We'll put all the information, like I said, on the show notes. Thank you so much for joining me today, scaring the hell out of me and enlightening me at the same time. I appreciate it.
Hey, Andrew, you asked some fantastic questions. I had a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy. See you soon. And there you go. All you need to know about artificial intelligence and hallucinations and political singularity and, I don't know, AGI. Wow. Pretty cool. So, hope you enjoyed that. And until next week, where I think we got Anthony Scaramucci coming on. We'll be talking probably about a lot of, I'm sure we're going to be talking about cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, political environment, and a whole host of other investments. Thanks for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.